Yeah, I just want to go over a little bit. I may have discussed this. These are the parshiyos of Melechus HaMishkan, and one of the 613 mitzvahs is to build a Beis HaMikdash. This is counted. And when Jews began coming to Eretz Yisrael in large numbers in the beginning of the 1800s, middle 1800s, Talmidim of the Gra came to Yerushalayim. Many Talmidim of the Baal Shem Tov came to Tveria. That's why Tveria has many Hasidish minhagim, and that's why Yerushalayim, the Ashkenazic minhagim, are those of the Gra, etc. So there began to be a discussion about bringing korbanos. You know, why can't we bring korbanos bisman hazeh? Now, putting aside the politics of it and everything else, but in pure halacha, are we allowed to bring korbanos today? Now here's the issue, Rebbe. So there was a great Talmud Chacham, Rav Tzvi Hirsch Kalischer, who was actually considered to be the founder of religious Zionism. You know, he was a Talmud Chacham, and he wrote Svarim, but he also wanted Jews to come back to Eretz Yisrael. So he was basically took the position that there's no halachic impediment in bringing korbanos, and he submitted this to the Gedolei Hador, and as you might expect, the Gedolei Hador all answered it, saying this is all Rabbi Kiva Eger, the Chassam Sofer, the Binyan Sion, that's the Orech Lener, they all wrote tshuvas. So Rabbi Kiva Eger gave a very cryptic tshuva. Rabbi Kiva Eger said, the reason we can't bring korbanos today is we cannot be machria, we cannot decide in a machlokas between the Rambam and the Ravid. Now, what machlokas the Rambam and the Ravid is he talking about? So this is a very important machlokas. It's very nogea l'maisa today. According to the Shitas HaRambam, the holiness of the Beis HaMikdash, the Harabayas, the holiness of the Makam HaMikdash, has not terminated. Even after Chorban, even after Galus, even after removal of the building, the Kedushas HaMikdash is still here, because the Kedushas HaMikdash is the place of the resting of the Shekhinah, and the Shekhinah is not bottled. The Shekhinah is always here. The Ravid says Kedushas HaMikdash is bottled after the Churban. So what's fascinating is that each opinion has a Kula and a Chumra. According to the Rambam, the Chumra would be, as we follow, that since all of us are Tomei today, because if you've ever been in a cemetery, you are Tomei, and the only possible way you can become Tohor is by the ashes of the Parah Aduma. Right? So if you're Tomei, you have no way of getting Tohor. A Tomei person who enters the Beis HaMikdash is Chayiv Kares. So according to the Rambam, you wouldn't be allowed to enter. That is why we Paskin, we don't enter the Makam HaMikdash. That would be the Chumra. According to the Ravid, you actually would be allowed to enter, because according to the Ravid, the Makam HaMikdash does not have Kedusha today after the Chorban, and therefore according to the Ravid, there's no Isser of a Tamei going in. So we are Machmir because we're not sure if the Halmer the Ravid, so it's a Safek Chi of Kares, we have to be Machmir. But what's interesting is the flip side is a little less apparent to people. That is, according to the Rambam, there's a gavaldiga leniency. Because since the Rambam maintains that the Makam HaMikdash still has Kedusha, you would be allowed to bring, not only allowed, you would be commanded to bring the Korban Tumid and the Korban Pesach, even Bizman HaZeh, because you still have the holiness of Mikdash. Now you may ask, well, that doesn't make sense. According to the Rambam, we just said you're not allowed to enter the place, so how are you going to bring a Korban there? The answer is no. It's true you're not allowed to enter the place, but for a korban sibur, for a communal offering, the laws of tumah are set aside, right? When most of the Jewish people are tamei, they're allowed to bring the korban. So like the Rambam, if I just want to take a tour of the Harabayas, it'll be an Isser D'Oraisa. But if I want to bring a korban, not a private korban, that wouldn't be allowed, but if I want to bring the korban tamid or the korban pesach, I would be permitted and therefore obligated. According to the Ravid, it's the opposite dynamic. Since the Makam HaMikdash does not have Kedusha, so the leniency is, I'm allowed to enter the area, I just want to take a trip, but if I bring a Korban on that site, bringing a site is just as bad as bringing a Korban in your backyard here, it's shechut echutz. It is bringing a korban outside of the Beis HaMikdash. In other words, even the site of the Beis HaMikdash is outside of the Beis HaMikdash because it doesn't have Kedusha. So Rabbi Kiveger's point in this very short tshuva is that since we have no way of deciding if the halacha is like the Rambam or like the Ravid, so we have to be machmir on both sides of the equation. We have to be machmir like the Rambam, that the makam is kadesh, and therefore we are not allowed to enter it. But we have to be machmir like the Ravid, that the makam is not kadesh, and therefore we are not permitted to bring korbanos, even under the principle that tuma is waived in the case of a korban sibur. Right, so this is what Rebbe Kiveger means. So essentially, when we say there's an Isser D'Oraisa of going into the Harabayas when you're Tameh, we don't mean for sure it's an Isser D'Oraisa. We mean it's a Machlokas, the Rambam, and the Ravid, and we're Machmer, because if it is Usser, it would be a Chiyuv Kares. So you have to be Machmer.
Say we were, would be permitted to bring Karbanos to this Manazah, even without a Beis HaMikdash. What exactly would you build him as back?
So here's the thing. Now, even though you don't need, in other words, according to the Rambam, you actually don't need a Beis HaMikdash to bring Korbanos because the Kedusha didn't leave. However, you do need a Mizbeach, so we would have to construct a Mizbeach, and in point of fact, it would have to be on the exact place where the Mizbeach is. Now, that's actually part of the other problem. We don't know exactly where the Mizbeach is, because the whole idea of superimposing the Beis HaMikdash on top of the Temple Mount is very uncertain. There are different, where is the Kodesh HaKodashim, you know, how do you measure it? So there is a problem. We don't know where the Mizbeach is, but we'd have to build a Mizbeach. Yeah, we'd have to build a Mizbeach. The question is, how could we build a Mizbeach? You're not supposed to use metal tools to cut. In the Beis HaMikdash, they used to have the Shamir. That's a miraculous little worm that would eat through stone. Well, actually, I'm thinking, the truth of the matter is, we have lasers, that's right, that's right. I just thought of that now, that's very interesting. We would cut the stones by laser, yeah, 100%, that's right. So Hashem Baruch Hu gave us the means of doing it, that's right. That's
but we
right.
don't have, we can't like, practically do it because...
Well, practically...
We don't know where everything goes, exactly.
That's correct, that's really the big one. In fact, Rav David Karliner was a great, great gadol. He's not so well known today, but he was a very great gadol in the generation of Rav Chaim and the Or Sameach. He was considered to be the greatest of them. Rav David Friedman, who was the Rav of Karlin, non-Hasidish Karlin. When you think Karliner, you think of the Hasidim, but he was very much a misnagid. But Rav David Karliner basically said, Rabbi Kiveger's Miman of Shech really doesn't work, because if the only problem that I can't bring a korban is because maybe it's not... Maybe the makam is not holy, and I'm bringing a korban in a non-sanctified place. But Rav David Karliner says, I'll give you a way to do it. Let's say I bring an animal, I sanctify it as the korban Pesach, but I sanctify it on a condition. I say, I am making this animal a korban Pesach if the halacha is like the Rambam, but if the halacha is like the Ravid, it's only chulin. So mimanafshach, I can take in that animal to the Harabais and shecht it, because like the Rambam, I'm shechting a Korban Pesach. And like the Ravid, I'm just shechting a regular animal. And then you have Kohanim who sprinkle the blood, so if it's a Pesach, it's a Pesach. If not, they're just throwing blood around. So Rav David Karliner says, if the only problem would be you couldn't bring a Korban, because maybe like the Ravid, you're over on bringing a Korban outside of the temple, you would have an eitz of conditional hekesh. So because of this, Rav David Friedman says, the real problem is, number one, where is the place of the Mizbeach? That's a big, big problem. Number two, we're not really certain who the Kohanim are. You know, over the years, the yichus, the lineage of all the Kohanim is very much in question. So certain things rely on, you know, getting the first aliyah, because that's not really a big deal, because... I mean, Manashech, if he's not a Kohen, so he can get the first Aliyah anyway, right? Even Duchening, because the idea is, if he's a Kohen, it's good, you know, but if he's not a Kohen, then it's not Birchas Kohenim, but it's not an Aveira per se.
But isn't it saying Hashem's name in vain?
Well, it's a Pasuk. Yeah, the Bracha would be in vain. Yeah, the Bracha. But the way this works is, since the recitation of Brachos on mitzvahs is a rabbinic commandment, the rabbis allowed us to rely on the general presumption. But when it comes to doing service in the temple, you have to know for sure you're a Kohen, right? So we don't really know. That's why we don't give Truma to a Kohen today. We separate Truma, we don't give it to a Kohen. Everybody's a Suffolk. You know?
Isn't there certain families? I heard that there's certain families that are known.
They do say, although we don't know that 100%, but they do say that certain Kohanim guarded the Yichus very well. They mentioned particularly the name Rappaport. You know Rappaport?
Yeah.
It's a name. Rappaport is a name of Kohanim, of a Kohen family, and they say that the Rappaport were very, very careful about Yichus. See, it's very easy for a Kohen. Well, if you're a Kohen, you cannot lose your status, no matter what you do, but it's very easy to cut it off from your children. For example, if a Kohen marries a divorced woman, he's still a Kohen. He's still a Kohen, even though he's doing an Aveira. Now, you know, he's not allowed to duch until he divorces his wife, but he is a Kohen. But the children that he has from that woman are Chalalim. They're no longer a Kohen. Remember the Gemara? You probably learned the first daf of Makos. Maha Mechalel Eino Mischalel. That means Mechalel. The one who desecrates his children does not become desecrated. That's going on that particular case. So if a Kohen marries a divorced woman, the kids are Chalalim. If a Kohen, and that ends it. They won't be Kohanim anymore. If a Kohen marries a Gioris, the kids are Chalalim. If a Kohen marries a Goya, for sure. If a Kohen marries a woman who had relations with a Goy. Now, a Kohen is allowed to marry a non-virgin if she's not divorced, if she's either widowed or even if she was Mizanet. But if she had relations with a non-Jew, a Kohen cannot marry her. And if a Kohen does marry her, the children are Chalalim. So it's very, very easy. And in the course of years, you know, many Kohanim are Bersuffic, whether they have the Yichus of Kohanim. In fact, there's another halacha. This is actually not so well known. I've come across even rabbis that didn't know this halacha because it's in an odd place in the Shulchan Aruch. It's not in the normal place where it should be, and so sometimes people don't realize it. And here's the halacha. Let's say you have a girl whose father is not Jewish and mother is Jewish. Right? A guy married a woman. It's not a marriage, of course. It's an intermarriage. But the daughter that's born is a Jew, 100% Jew. But there actually is a din that even though she's not a convert, she is a born Jewish woman, she is not allowed to marry a Kohen. Now, this, however, is a very, very strange halacha, because this is the only case where a woman is not allowed to marry a Kohen, but if she did, she's allowed to stay married. In other words, and it doesn't make the kids chalalim. You know, it's an interesting shaila, because it's a whole sugi nivamas, that d'oraisa it is mutter, it's an issur d'rabbanan. And Svardim are even more mekel. Svardim basically say if they already got engaged, they're allowed to, you know, if a couple came to you, according to Rav Avadya Yosef, if a couple came to me, a Kohen and a girl whose father was not Jewish, and they're already engaged, and they asked me to be Masadar Kedushin, I would be allowed to be Masadar Kedushin. Okay, that's a very big kula. I mean, the Gemara literally says only if they married, but he says married is lavdavka. Married just means that they've already made a commitment.
Are the kids still chulin, though? The kids of that couple?
Yeah, so the kids of that couple are Kohanim. Yeah, they're not Chalalim.
They are Kohanim.
Yeah, they will be Kohanim.
Oh.
Yeah, I believe so, yeah.
But lechatchila, you shouldn't do it?
Lechatchila, they should not get married. But that's the only case, that's the only Kohanic prohibition which is a lechatchila prohibition. That's not b'diyah, but every other one, if a Kohen marries a divorced woman or whatever, they are mechuyev to separate. They're not allowed to stay together. This is the only exception of something that's lechatchila. It's a very unusual halacha. Lechatchila, they don't get married, but if they got married, lechatchila, they're allowed to stay together. It's lechatchila, once they're married, they are allowed to stay together. But that's a little known halacha, and that's... it's okay. I mean, listen, you know, one of the issues that a Baal Tshuva, that's a Kohen, has, let's say, you know, is when you're older, maybe when you're younger, it's not such a big problem, but if you, let's say, you're 30, 35 years old, or whatever it would be, so you generally will marry somebody around your age. And usually, not always, usually the Baal Tshuva will marry a Balas Tshuva who had a similar type of background, although not always. So the problem is, in our day and age, the age of sexual liberation, many women who are, or if they were not religious by the time they're in their 30s, they had relations with people, and often the people they have are goyim. So a kohen, an older kohen, might find it very, very difficult to find a marriage partner. Either a woman his age is divorced, which, you know, or the woman his age had relations with a non-Jew, in which, in both cases, he's not allowed to marry her. So because of this, you actually have, you know, it's a paradox now. Many people look for ways to resign their kahuna. Being a kohen is a great honor, great kavod. A person is going to have the sechus of doing the avodah in the Beis HaMikdash, but they want to resign it. Now, of course, you can't resign your kahuna. You can't resign it. It's not possible. Of course, you know, this is a joke that the rabbis like to say. It's a well-known rabbinic joke about a guy that went to a rabbi and said, you know, Rabbi, I want to give your shul $10,000 if you make me a kohen. So the rabbi said, you know, I can use the money, but I can't make you a kohen. He says, $20,000. And he keeps on pushing and pushing and pushing. The rabbi says, no, I can't. Finally, he says, well, you know, my father was a kohen, and I just want to, you know, I want the same honor. But if he already was a kohen. But Rav Moshe has a tshuva. Rav Moshe has a very interesting tshuva, where Rav Moshe says, in many cases, if a person only knows he's a kohen because of relatives who themselves are not Shomer Shabbos, parents or uncles, he says they don't have nemanis to make him a kohen. And he's allowed to assume he comes from the majority of Jews who are not Kohanim. I actually know an actual case of friends of mine. This was somebody, he was a Jewish man who was raised as a Kohen, non-religious. He married a non-Jewish woman, not a Gioris. He married a non-Jewish woman, intermarriage. They had children. And as sometimes happens, she got interested in Yiddishkeit. It's often the non-Jewish woman who gets interested in Yiddishkeit, and she was becoming more and more religious. And she was ready for an Orthodox conversion. But here was the problem. In order for there to be an Orthodox conversion, you have to accept the commandments. You have to accept the mitzvahs. Now, one of the commandments are that a kohen cannot marry a kohen. Now, of course, a kohen cannot marry a goy. They're committing a sin. Okay, that's fine. But if we are to convert her, she has to accept the law that a gioris cannot be married to a kohen. And if she were to say, I can't accept that law, we would not be allowed to convert. So...
He also was becoming interested?
He was becoming interested, but mainly because of her. It wasn't his, but he was going to do what she wanted to do. So the Beis Din called her in, and the Beis Din said, without her husband there, you know, we're going to ask Rav Moshe Feinstein, we're going to ask Gadol HaDor, we don't want to paskin this by ourselves, but are you aware of the fact that if we convert you, you may have to leave your husband? You may possibly not be allowed to stay with your husband. So she broke down sobbing, and she said, if this is the will of Hashem, I accept it. It would be very, very hard for me, but I accept the will of Hashem. They were testing her sincerity. They then called in the man and said, you know, if we convert your wife, you may have to get a divorce. So he said, you guys are nuts. He said, you guys are nuts. And he stormed out. Anyway, the Beis Din didn't want a paskin on their own. So they asked Rav Moshe Feinstein, Shaila. And Rav Moshe says, well, you say he's a Kohen. How do you know he's a Kohen? Because his father told him he's a Kohen. But his father is a Mechal Shabbos. His father has no Nemanis. So Rav Moshe passed. Now, this is not an indiscriminate...
What's
No, trustworthiness. Trustworthiness. So Rav Moshe says, in such a situation, once you're already married, and once you already have children, and it would be the breakup of a family, you can be somech you can rely on the majority of Jews who are not Kohanim, and you can assume you're not a Kohen, you're allowed to stay married. Now, this is not a heter for a Kohen l'chatchila to go ahead and date Gioris and everything else, but in this type of unusual situation. So as a result, the Geiris took place, and now Baruch Hashem, it's a very firm family with Bnei Torah and the like. And it's funny, his father, until his father was Nifter, was not religious, but his father still treated himself as a Kohen. So when he came to visit his son, he would get the first Aliyah, and the son would get the Yisrael or whatever it would be. But the husband tells me that he does have nightmares that when Mashiach comes, he will discover that he is a Kohen, and he'll have to leave his wife. So he's really worried. But I felt, I told him, listen, if a Moshe Feinstein Paskin, you're not a Kohen, then in Shemayim it'll work out that you're not a Kohen. Because Baruch would not allow. In fact, they tell a story about Rav Moshe in the same vein about another Rav. This was a very, very... That Rav Moshe believed, again, it's a teaching of Chazal, that the people who are given the achrayas of being the poskim for the door are given special siyata dishmaya, that Hashem will guide us to be emes, even though there's no absolute guarantee. So they tell a story about a woman. A woman came after the Holocaust, and a woman came to Rav Moshe with this story, and he said... her husband was taken to a concentration camp, and she heard nothing about it, and she went to a Beis Din with a certain Chashev Rav who was no longer alive, and the Beis Din permitted her to get married, and she got married to a second guy, and now she's married for like a few years, and all of a sudden the first husband showed up. And what is she supposed to do? Because the Mishnah says in Yevamos that when a woman remarries thinking her husband is dead and he turns out to be alive, she has to leave both husbands. She cannot be with the second or the first. And any kid she has, her mom's favorite. So everybody was listening to this and they were crying, and what a tragic, tragic story. And Rav Moshe kept on asking her more and more questions, almost in a very harsh way. Tell me what the heter was. What did they tell you? What did they tell you? Why did they tell you? And this was very unlike Rav Moshe, who was very, very soft and gentle all the time. And finally, Rav Moshe said to the woman, I'm sorry, you're lying. He said, a Rav didn't give you a heter. He says, I knew this Rav, and I know Hashem would not have allowed him to give a psak. That would have meant you're committing adultery. So you got married without going to the Rav. Is that right? And she broke down and she said, it's still a tragedy, and it doesn't make the tragedy go away, but Rav Moshe was so batuach that had she gotten a heter from this Rav, that there would not have been a problem. You know, so Rav Moshe said to her, you're lying and you have to tell the truth. And she admitted that she just decided on her own that her husband was probably dead, and unfortunately she made an error. Now, I don't know, I mean, that's not a happy ending to the story. The story is still a bad story, but L'chalapach, as Rav Moshe said, that it would not, a takala, a stumbling block, would not come out of a basin's psalm.
Let's say a
coin
was just a Baal Shuvah or something. So can we assume that he's a coin, just to give an aliyah? I mean, on the basis of that logic, why would we assume that anyone...
Yeah, so again, the basic rule is, that for the inyanim of yichus b'zman hazeh, if it's not to do service in the Beis HaMikdash or eating truma, so we're makabel, even the edus of people who are not religious, meaning we normally assume parents don't lie to children and the like. So we're allowed to give them an aliyah based on that. The point is that we're not mechuyev to give that nemanus if it involves breaking up a marriage or the like. So there's such a thing as we're allowed to accept it, but we're not obligated to accept it in situations where it would cause a great hardship. Yeah.
Would similar logic at all apply? Like, why we would believe, like, non-from Jews that they're Jewish and that they...
It's very similar. It is very similar. You know, we believe anybody who... we believe anybody who says they're Jewish. Now, some people are saying it's going to change today, because in the olden days, there was only two ways to become Jewish. Either you were born from a Jewish mother, or you had an Orthodox conversion. There was no other type of conversion. So even if you weren't religious, you know, you weren't confused about what it means to be Jewish, so you would be believed to say my mother was Jewish, or you're believed to say I had an Orthodox conversion. The problem today is that there's all sorts of definitions of Jewish, because now we have Reform conversions, we have, you know, things like that. We have, in fact, you don't even need a conversion. According to the Reform movement, there is also patrilineal descent. That means in the Reform movement, if your father is Jewish and your mother is not, did not convert, you don't need conversion. You are considered to be Jewish with either parent. So now, if somebody says, it's a real problem, if somebody says, I'm Jewish, you know, we're not accusing him of lying, but, you know, well, because his mother told him he's Jewish. Well, maybe his grandfather was, in other words, maybe his grandmother was a Goy and his grandfather was Jewish, and therefore the mother, you know, calls herself Jewish based on Reform definition or whatever. And how far do you go back? Now, we're still within a small enough number of years that we can go back a little bit. We can go back to grandfather, great-grandfather. You know, beyond that, they probably weren't even Reform, you know, so at that point you could trace it. But if Mashiach doesn't come, Chas v'Shalom, you know, in 50 years, it's going to be very, very difficult to believe somebody who says they're Jewish if they're coming from a non-religious background, because there are going to be so many possible pathways in which their Judaism could have been compromised. So it's a very, very, very serious problem. I mean, people are talking about the fact that there's going to come a time when Jews will not be allowed to marry other Jews because they will have a suffix whether the people who say they're Jews are Jews. Now, I want to mention one thing. A few years ago, they discovered a genetic marker to show that, and it only goes down through the males, only through the male line, which indicates you come from Aaron, genetic marker for a Kohen. So people were very excited because this could show that people are a Kohen. But you think about it, a genetic marker of this nature can only negate kahuna, it cannot establish it. In other words, like this. One might argue that if you don't have the marker, you're not descended from Aaron. But if you have the marker, so what? I mean, if a Kohen marries a Goy, and the kid is a Goy, he's going to have the genetic marker from his father. So, obviously, Kohen marries a Grusha, Kohen marries a Gioris, Kohen marries a Goya, right? All of these different things. So, there's no possible way that a genetic marker can make somebody a Kohen. The most you could say is the absence of the marker could establish that a person is not a Kohen. So, you have to be very careful about that as well, yeah.
Do you still have the same problem amongst Reform communities like they had in Germany, in Sephardic countries? Do we still have the same chashash, that one might have from areas where Reform movement existed? There a Reform movement in Sephardic?
No, Sephardim never had Reform movements. That's interesting. A Sephardim, not every Sephardi was religious, that's very clear. But if a Sephardi was not religious, he didn't try to create his own religion. A Sephardi understood that to be a good Jew was to keep the commandments. And some of them did, some of them didn't. But even a Sephardi that didn't, even in Israel today, very traditional. I mean, when they daven, they'll go to an Orthodox synagogue, you know, even if it's only a few times a year. So Sephardim never had, absolutely never had a Reform movement. And they certainly never did non-halachic conversions. Everything. Again, Sephardim to this day have a tremendous respect for their rabbis. I mean, Rav Avadya Zelvaya. Not everybody at Rav Avadya Zelvaya was Orthodox. You know, I mean, he was like a folk hero among hundreds of thousands of people who were not even religious. They looked up to him and they admired him and they followed him. So Sephardim, you don't have that problem. Now, you do know Sephardim, not all Sephardim. There's one kahila of Sephardim in New York, the Syrian kahila. Mm-hmm. That made a takana, very strange takana. I mean, one might even think they're over in Isser D'Oraisa with this takana, in which they do not accept any converts in their tekahila, converts. No matter, a person could have a geiris with the greatest gedolim of the world. They don't consider it valid. And if any of their children marries a geiris, of their daughters marries a geir, they excommunicate them. Now, that's very extreme, and one might say, hey, there's an issue of the oraisa, not to embarrass a geir. If somebody is a geir, if they're not a geir, it's one thing, but if it was a valid geiris, how can you say they're no good? But they made a gezeira because there were so many conversions in America.